Monster Man, Episode 457, White and Will-O-Wisp. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. But before we do that, a quick note from our sponsor, which is me. Don't forget that my zine, The Guide to Grunts, is currently crowdfunding. It's a system-neutral resource for creating the cultures and societies of armies and military units for your fantasy role-playing games. It's cheap, it should be good fun, it's got beautiful art by Letty Wilson, and you should check it out. There's a link in the show notes. Thank you. Okay, our first monster for today is the White. This entry is very similar to the entry in Monster Manual, including repeating things like the etymology part, right? So white used to just mean person. Tolkien used the term Barrow Whites to mean, like, people of the Barrow, people who didn't know what that meant, because unlike Tolkien, they weren't, you know, historical linguists or whatever, started to use it to just to mean that kind of monster. And I guess the purpose of the etymology bit is to protect the authors against criticism, right? Like, why didn't you dummies know what this word meant? But never mind that. Interestingly, I feel like there is something kind of early medieval about the white. They're kind of the overlooked undead, aren't they? They sort of don't have as distinctive a role in the D&D canon as the lich, or in, like, the global understanding of monsters as the zombie or the skeleton, or the vampire for that matter, right? A lot of iconic monsters in the undead ranks, and then we kind of have the white, who, although it is rooted in folklore and in other sort of literary traditions, I'm not sure that it's really as big a deal as some of the other ones, and I think that's kind of a shame. To me, the white represents like a pretty typical monster from medieval Scandinavian literature, what would be called a drow. My pronunciation might be wrong there, it might be something more like droi. I don't know very much about the pronunciation of Old Norse, and I took half a year of introduction to Icelandic, and that was over 15 years ago. But to me, that's what this monster represents, is the kind of like burial mound dweller that fights a hero in a Norse saga. And I think that Tolkien was definitely drawing on that tradition, the idea that readers could expect the treasures of a burial mound to be guarded by their undead inhabitants. And those creatures can also be kind of haunts. You get that in Norse sagas as well. So they're what we would call ghosts, but they're quite physical. I feel like Grettir fights a bunch of these guys in the eponymous Grettir saga. And is it Bard's saga that has like a whole sort of Viking ship full of undead rowers? I don't remember. That sounds right, but I have no evidence. So I quite like whites, and I do like the fact that their motivation is that they're hateful and malevolent. They just hate life. They hate the living. This, I think, reflects a pretty common anxiety about death, right? That death is presented as an inimical force to life, and not just something that happens to you at the end of your life, but that death hates you and is out to get you. The world is therefore portrayed as a struggle between life and death, and whites have that horrifying aspect of the inimical dead without the kind of like pitiful aspect that zombies and skeletons have. You almost feel sorry for zombies and skeletons. You know, zombies are clearly suffering and skeletons are just kind of like, it's a sad fate. You know, not, I said this before about lots of other monsters, but not only do you not want them to get you, but you don't want to end up like them. And whites have the don't want them to get you dial turned way up, and the don't want to end up like them dial turned way down. Or rather, the white perhaps is the body of the kind of person who doesn't mind ending up like a white, because you're strong and you scare people. And the fact that you're sitting in cheerless state in your burial mound, surrounded by gold cups and things that will no longer hold ale for feasting with your hearth companions, that's really sad from a kind of, like, Old English, Old Norse perspective, but the kind of person that winds up becoming a white is not the kind of person who understands why that is sad. So they're there in that tragic environment, but they think that it rules. Or maybe they can't admit to themselves that it's tragic, and that's why they're so mad all the time. But someone who has a treasure hoard defended by a Viking ship full of skeleton rowers, and them sitting there being like a scary white in a dark burial mound with, you know, rain dripping through the earthen roof. Yeah, that's a pretty good monster, and whites are pretty good. I do like a mechanic that I don't think I noticed previously, which is that when you kill a white, the other whites that it has created actually get stronger. This is an interesting contrast to the normal vampire, where it's kind of like, oh, well, if you kill the master vampire, then all the other vampires will die or be freed from the curse. Next up, we have the Will-O-Wisp. The Will-O-Wisp entry is the entry from Monster Manual, but expanded. One thing that's missing from this entry is the connection to the Boggart, which is interesting because, like, that sort of tells us a little bit something about the sort of production and selection of monsters in this book, because, of course, the fact that there's a relationship between Boggarts and Will-O-Wisps is in the Boggart entry, but it's not in the Will-O-Wisp entry in first edition, because Boggarts come out after Will-O-Wisps do. So we've just kind of given up on that Boggart connection, which is fine. The Boggart was, frankly, surplus to requirements, and that frees up the name for us to call something else a Boggart. What's interesting to me about this entry is how heavily it's been scientified. This is a recurring trend in this edition. And actually, you know, I was in Edinburgh last week, and I was talking to a colleague. We were discussing the way monster descriptions change, and without any prompting from me, one of the first things he said was they get kind of scientific, and they get, he called it the application of a rational episteme to something that is not normally, that's not normally the way we would think about it, which I thought was a good way, you know, a more precise way, I guess, of saying what I've been saying about these things for a while. The application of a rational episteme. I feel fancy now. But it's true that the Will-O-Wisp has been heavily scientified. So we're told, for example, that Will-O-Wisps speak in, like, breathy, ghostly voices, which makes sense. They're kind of spectral beings. But that this is because they produce sounds by vibrating very rapidly. And instead of, like, wanting to feed on the terror of the people they kill, we're specifically told that they feed on the fury of electrical activity given off by the brains of panic-stricken individuals as they realize that death is inescapable. Like, I feel like this is taking a pretty straightforward fantasy concept and giving it a pseudoscientific gloss, but kind of for no reason, because none of this is going to be important in the way that players interact with a Will-O-Wisp, right? If you've got a Will-O-Wisp in your game, it's either because it's luring the players off the path, or because the players are looking for somebody who got lured off the path. The important thing is the luring off the path. It is very difficult to imagine the circumstances under which the fact that the Will-O-Wisp feeds on the electrical activity and not, say, the magical energy generated by a person's death, or, for that matter, that Will-O-Wisps are just bad guys who like to kill people, or that they're just a naturally occurring phenomenon, or like a little fairy creature that just flies around and it can't help if you follow it, or that they're the ghosts of people who died in those dangerous places. It could be anything. You know, but they've gone with this electrical activity argument, but it's all behind the curtain. It's never going to come up in game. And if it did, it would be like a jarring distraction from the tone of the game, or would it? Because, as I said, that style is so prevalent throughout the book that maybe this is the tone of the game? While reading this, I wondered if this style became so prevalent because it's what you get when you are digging deeper and trying to expand simple concepts in a setting-independent way. Magic works differently depending on, like, which D&D world you're in. So a Will-O-Wisp in Dark Sun might be different from Will-O-Wisp in Ravenloft, might be different from a Will-O-Wisp in, I don't know, Greyhawk, or the Forgotten Realm. It doesn't really matter which one you're in if you're talking about the kind of scientific or pseudoscientific basis for how a Will-O-Wisp works. Now, it should, but it doesn't. That's a thing. I don't get any of this stuff. To me, how did the goose that laid the golden eggs affect the currency markets in Fairyland is like a category error. I'm interested in thinking about these things typically from like a creative standpoint rather than from like imagining the world realistically and imagining myself into it. And that's maybe just because I tend to think about games as a game master rather than as a player, or as a game writer rather than as a player. But also, it's not really how I engage with them as a player either. And to me, this isn't something that would result from immersion. It's something that would harm my immersion. It feels like a joke about not having a kind of sense of wonder about fantasy settings. There's part of me that tends to think in terms of like the publishing process and whatever, that would be fascinated to discover that this was essentially a consequence of the publishing needs of TSR. All of these ecology articles, these kind of bland first takes, typically, you know, they're a product of the demand for content to keep the never-stopping Expressive Dragon magazine running. And I feel like here's a thing that, you know, quote-unquote exists in the game, come up with an explanation for it, is easier than come up with a wholly new thing. At least to me. It's the kind of writing that I find pretty straightforward. But you have that danger where everything gets footnoted to death, and the footnotes, because they're done in a hurry, done by people who aren't maybe all that invested in it, etc., they're maybe not as good as they might be. Which is not to say there's anything wrong with Will-O-Wisps. Will-O-Wisps are fine, but I thought that this entry was interesting in that respect. Anyway, that's about all the monsters that we have time for today. We have a bonus episode coming out this week for Patreon subscribers at all levels, covering what I've been up to in February. And at the end of this week, we're going to have a special episode about some monsters created by one of our listeners. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@Dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.